beside him. Momentarily, he lowered a curtain of forgetfulness across his vision. He might just be standing here with his eyes closed. Time refused to stand still for him, though. He inhaled darkness, starless, tearless. His affliction dissolved substance until all that remained was astonishment at the way sounds condensed his universe. Everything around him leaned on his lonely sense of hearing, falling back only when he touched objects, the drapery, Cheney's hand. He caught himself listening for Cheney's breaths. Where was the insecurity of things that were only probable? He asked himself. His mind carried such a burden of mutilated memories. For every instant of reality there existed countless projections, things fated never to be. An invisible self within him remembered the false pasts, their burden threatening at times to overwhelm the present. Cheney leaned against his arm. He felt his body through her touch, dead flesh carried by time eddies. He reeked of memories that had glimpsed eternity. To see eternity was to be exposed to eternity's whims, oppressed by endless dimensions. The Oracle's false immortality demanded retribution. Past and future became simultaneous. Once more, the vision arose from its black pit, locked onto him. It was his eyes. It moved his muscles. It guided him into the next moment, the next hour, the next day, until he felt himself to be always there.
"It's time we were going," Cheney said. "The council."
"Aaliyah will be there to stand in my place."
"Does she know what to do?"
"She knows." Aaliyah's day began with a guard squadron swarming into the parade yard below her quarters. She stared down at a scene of frantic confusion, clamorous and intimidating babble. The scene became intelligible only when she recognized the prisoner they'd brought, Korba, the panegyrist. She made her morning toilet, moving occasionally to the window, keeping watch on the progress of impatience down there. Her gaze kept straying to Korba. She tried to remember him as the rough and bearded commander of the third wave in the Battle of Arakeen. It was impossible. Korba had become an immaculate fop, dressed now in a parato silk robe of exquisite cut. It lay open to the waist, revealing a beautifully laundered ruff and embroidered undercoat set with green gems. A purple belt gathered the waist. The sleeves poking through the robe's armhole slits had been tailored into rivulet ridges of dark green and black velvet. A few naibs had come out to observe the treatment accorded a fellow Fremen. They'd brought on the clamour, exciting Korba to protest his innocence. Aaliyah moved her gaze across the Fremen faces, trying to recapture memories of the original men. The present blotted out the past. They'd all become hedonists, samplers of pleasures most men couldn't even imagine. Their uneasy glances, she saw, strayed often to the doorway into the chamber where they would meet. They were thinking of Muad'Dib's blind sight, a new manifestation of mysterious powers. By their law, a blind man should be abandoned in the desert, his water given up to Shai Hulud. But Eyeless Muad'Dib saw them. They disliked buildings, too, and felt vulnerable in space built above the ground. Give them a proper cave cut from rock, then they could relax, but not here. Not with this new Muad'Dib waiting inside. As she turned to go down to the meeting, she saw the letter where she'd left it on a table by the door, the latest message from their mother. Despite the special reverence held for Caladan as the place of Paul's birth, the Lady Jessica had emphasized her refusal to make her planet a stop on the Hajj.
"No doubt my son is an epical figure of history," she'd written, "but I cannot see this as an excuse for submitting to a rabble invasion."
Aaliyah touched the letter, experienced an odd sensation of mutual contact. This paper had been in her mother's hands. Such an archaic device, the letter, but personal in a way no recording could achieve. Written in the Atreides' battle tongue, it represented an almost invulnerable privacy of communication. Thinking of her mother afflicted Aaliyah with the usual inward blurring. The spice change that had mixed the psyches of mother and daughter forced her at times to think of Paul as a son to whom she had given birth. the capsule complex of oneness could present her own father as a lover. Ghost shadows cavorted in her mind, people of possibility. Alia reviewed the letter as she walked down the ramp to the antechamber where her guard Amazons waited.
"You produce a deadly paradox," Jessica had written. "Government cannot be religious and self-assertive at the same time. Religious experience needs a spontaneity which laws inevitably suppress. And you cannot govern without laws. Your laws eventually must replace morality, replace conscience, replace even the religion by which you think to govern. Sacred ritual must spring from praise and holy yearnings which hammer out a significant morality. Government, on the other hand, is a cultural organism particularly attractive to doubts, questions, and contentions. I see the day coming when ceremony must take the place of faith and symbolism replaces morality."
The smell of spice coffee greeted Alia in the antechamber. Four guard Amazons in green watch robes came to attention as she entered. They fell into step behind her, striding firmly in the bravado of their youth, eyes alert for trouble. They had zealot faces untouched by awe. They radiated that special Fremen quality of violence. They could kill casually, with no sense of guilt.
"In this I am different," Alia thought. "The Atreides' name has enough dirt on it without that."
Word preceded her. A waiting page darted off as she entered the lower hall, running to summon the full guard detail. The hall stretched out, windowless and gloomy, illuminated only by a few subdued glow globes. Abruptly, the doors to the parade yard opened wide at the far end to admit a glaring shaft of daylight. The guard, with Korba in their midst, wavered into view from the outside, with a light behind them.
"Where is Stilga?" Alia demanded.
"Already inside," one of her Amazons said.
Alia led the way into the chamber. It was one of the keep's more pretentious meeting places, a high balcony with rows of soft seats occupied one side. Across from the balcony, orange draperies had been pulled back from tall windows. Bright sunlight poured through from an open space with a garden and a fountain. At the near end of the chamber, on her right, stood a dais with a single, massive chair. Moving to the chair, Alia glanced back and up, saw the gallery filled with naibs. Household guardsmen packed the open space beneath the gallery, Stilgar moving among them with a quiet word here, a command there. He gave no sign that he'd seen Alia enter. Korba was brought in, seated at a low table with cushions beside it on the chamber floor below the dais. Despite his finery, the panegyrist gave the appearance now of a surly, sleepy old man huddled up in his robes as against the outer cold. Two guardsmen took up positions behind him. Stilgar approached the dais as Alia seated herself.
"Where is Muad'Dib?" he asked.
"My brother has delegated me to preside as Reverend Mother," Alia said.
Hearing this, the naibs in the gallery began raising their voices in protest.
"Silence!"
Alia commanded. In the abrupt quiet, she said,
"Is it not Fremen law that a Reverend Mother presides when life and death are at issue?"
As the gravity of her statement penetrated, stillness came over the naibs. But Alia marked angry stares across the row of faces. She named them in her mind for discussion in council. Hobars, Rajifiri, Tasmin, Sajid, Umba, Leg. The names carried places of dune in them. Umbo Siech, Tasmin Sink, Hobars Gap. She turned her attention to Korba. Observing her attention, Korba lifted his chin, said,
"I protest my innocence."
"Stilgar, read the charges," Alia said.
Stilgar produced a brown spice paper scroll, stepped forward. He began reading, a solemn flourish in his voice, as though to hidden rhythms. He gave the words an incisive quality, clear and full of probity.
"That you did conspire with traitors to accomplish the destruction of our lord and emperor. That you did meet in vile secrecy with diverse enemies of the realm. That you—"
Korba kept shaking his head with a look of pained anger. Alia listened broodingly, chin planted on her left fist, head cocked to that side, the other arm extended along the chair arm. Bits of the formal procedure began dropping out of her awareness, screened by her own feelings of disquiet.
"Venerable tradition, support of the legions and all Fremen everywhere. Violence met with violence according to the law. Majesty of the imperial person, forfeit all rights to—"
It was nonsense, she thought. Nonsense, all of it. Nonsense, nonsense, nonsense. Stilgar finished.
"Thus the issue is brought to judgment."
In the immediate silence, Korba rocked forward, hands gripping his knees, veined neck stretched as though he were preparing to leap. His tongue flicked between his teeth as he spoke.
"Not by word or deed have I been traitor to my Fremen vows. I demand to confront my accuser."
A simple enough protest, Alia thought. And she saw that it had produced a considerable effect on the Naibs. They knew Korba. He was one of them. To become a Naib, he'd proved his Fremen courage and caution. Not brilliant, Korba, but reliable. Not one to lead a jihad, perhaps, but a good choice as supply officer. Not a crusader, but one who cherished the old Fremen virtues. The tribe is paramount. Othheim's bitter words as Paul had recited them swept through Alia's mind. She scanned the gallery. Any of those men might see himself in Korba's place, some for good reason, but an innocent Naib was as dangerous as a guilty one here. Korba felt it too.
"Who accuses me?"
he demanded.
"I have a Fremen right to confront my accuser."
"Perhaps you accuse yourself," Alia said.
Before he could mask it, mystical terror lay briefly on Korba's face. It was there for anyone to read. With her powers, Alia had but to accuse him herself, saying she brought the evidence from the Shadow Region, the Alam al-Mithal.
"Our enemies have Fremen allies," Alia pressed. "Water traps have been destroyed, kanats blasted, plantings poisoned, and storage basins plundered."
"And now they've stolen a worm from the desert, taken it to another world."
The voice of this intrusion was known to all of them, Muad'Dib. Paul came through the doorway from the hall, pressed through the guard ranks and crossed to Alia's side. Chaney, accompanying him, remained on the sidelines.
"My lord,"
Stilgar said, refusing to look at Paul's face. Paul aimed his empty sockets at the gallery, then down to Korba.
"What, Korba? No words of praise?"
Muttering could be heard in the gallery. It grew louder, isolated words and phrases audible.
"Law for the blind. Fremen way, in the desert. Who breaks?"
"Who says I'm blind?"
Paul demanded. He faced the gallery.
"You, Rajafiri? I see you're wearing gold today, and that blue shirt beneath it which still has dust on it from the streets. You always were untidy."
Rajafiri made a warding gesture, three fingers against evil.
"Point those fingers at yourself," Paul shouted. "We know where the evil is."
He turned back to Korba.
"There's guilt on your face, Korba."
"Not my guilt. I may have associated with the guilty, but no—"
He broke off, shot a frightened look at the gallery. Taking her cue from Paul, Alia arose, stepped down to the floor of the chamber, advanced to the edge of Korba's table. From a range of less than a meter, she stared down at him, silent and intimidating. Korba cowered under the burden of eyes. He fidgeted, shot anxious glances at the gallery.
"Whose eyes do you seek up there?" Paul asked.
"You cannot see," Korba blurted.
Paul put down a momentary feeling of pity for Korba. The man lay trapped in the vision's snare as securely as any of those present. He played a part, no more.
"I don't need eyes to see you," Paul said.
And he began describing Korba, every movement, every twitch, every alarmed and pleading look at the gallery. Desperation grew in Korba. Watching him, Alia saw he might break any second. Someone in the gallery must realize how near he was to breaking, she thought. Who? She studied the faces of the Naibs, noting small betrayals in the masked faces, angers, fears, uncertainties, guilts. Paul felt silent. Korba mustered a pitiful air of pomposity to plead,
"Who accuses me?"
"Othheim accuses you," Alia said.
"But Othheim's dead,"
Korba protested.
"How did you know that?" Paul asked. "Through your spy system?" "Oh yes, we know about your spies and couriers. We know who brought the stone burner here from Tarahel."
"It was for the defense of the Kizarat,"
Korba blurted.
"Is that how it got into traitorous hands?" Paul asked.
"It was stolen and we..."
Korba fell silent, swallowed. His gaze darted left and right.
"Everyone knows I've been the voice of love for Muad'Dib."
He stared at the gallery.
"How can a dead man accuse a Fremen?"
"Othheim's voice isn't dead," Alia said.
She stopped as Paul touched her arm.
"Othheim sent us his voice," Paul said. "It gives the names, the acts of treachery, the meeting places, and the times. Do you miss certain faces in the Council of Naibs, Korba? Where are Merkur and Fash? Keke the Lame isn't with us today. And Takim, where is he?"
Korba shook his head from side to side.
"They've fled Arrakis with the stolen worm," Paul said. "Even if I freed you now, Korba, Shai Hulud would have your water for your part in this. Why don't I free you, Korba? Think of all those men whose eyes were taken, the men who cannot see as I see. They have families and friends, Korba. Where could you hide from them?"
"It was an accident,"
Korba pleaded.
"Anyway, they're getting Tleilaxu."
Again he subsided.
"Who knows what bondage goes with metal eyes?" Paul asked.
The Naibs in their gallery began exchanging whispered comments, speaking behind raised hands. They gazed coldly at Korba now.
"Defense of the Kizarat," Paul murmured,
returning to Korba's plea.
"A device which either destroys a planet or produces J-rays to blind those too near it. Which effect, Korba, did you conceive as a defense? Does the Kizarat rely on stopping the eyes of all observers?"
"It was a curiosity, my lord,"
Korba pleaded.
"We knew the old law said that only families could possess atomics, but the Kizarat obeyed.
"Obeyed you," Paul said. "A curiosity indeed."
"Even if it's only the voice of my accuser, you must face me with it,"
Korba said.
"A Fremen has rights."
"He speaks truth, sire,"
Stilgar said. Alia glanced sharply at Stilgar.
"The law is the law,"
Stilgar said, sensing Alia's protest. He began quoting Fremen law, interspersing his own comments on how the law pertained. Alia experienced the odd sensation she was hearing Stilgar's words before he spoke them. How could he be this credulous? Stilgar had never appeared more official and conservative, more intent on adhering to the Dune Code. His chin was outthrust, aggressive, his mouth chopped. Was there really nothing in him but this outrageous pomposity?
"Korba is a Fremen, and must be judged by Fremen law," Stilgar concluded.
Alia turned away, looked out at the day shadows dropping down the wall across from the garden. She felt drained by frustration. They'd dragged this thing along well into mid-morning. Now, what? Korba had relaxed. The panegyrist's manner said he'd suffered an unjust attack, that everything he'd done had been for love of Muad'Dib. She glanced at Korba, surprised a look of sly self-importance sliding across his face. He might almost have received a message, she thought. He acted the part of a man who'd heard friends shout, "Hold fast, help is on its way." For an instant, they'd held this thing in their hands, the information out of the dwarf, the clues that others were in the plot, the names of informants, but the critical moment had flown. Stilgar? Surely not Stilgar. She turned, stared at the old Fremen. Stilgar met her gaze without flinching.
"Thank you, Still," Paul said, "for reminding us of the law."
Stilgar inclined his head. He moved close, shaped silent words in a way he knew both Paul and Alia could read.
"I'll wring him dry and then take care of the matter."
Paul nodded, signalled the guardsmen behind Korba.
"Remove Korba to a maximum security cell," Paul said. "No visitors except council. As council, I appoint Stilgar."
"Let me choose my own council,"
Korba shouted. Paul whirled.
"You deny the fairness and judgment of Stilgar?"
"Oh, no, my lord, but—"
"Take him away," Paul barked.
The guardsmen lifted Korba off the cushions, herded him out. With new mutterings, the naibs began quitting their gallery. Attendants came from beneath the gallery, crossed to the windows, and drew the orange draperies. Orange gloom took over the chamber.
"Paul,"
Alia said.
"When we precipitate violence," Paul said, "it'll be when we have full control of it. Thank you, Still. You played your part well. Alia, I'm certain, has identified the naibs who were with him. They couldn't help giving themselves away."
"You cooked this up between you?" Alia demanded.
"Had I ordered Korba slain out of hands, the naibs would have understood," Paul said. "But this formal procedure, without strict adherence to Fremen law, they felt their own rights threatened." "Which naibs were with him, Alia?"
"Rajifiri, for certain," she said, voice low. "And Sajid, but—"
"Give Stilgar the complete list," Paul said.
Alia swallowed in a dry throat, sharing the general fear of Paul in this moment. She knew how he moved among them without eyes, but the delicacy of it daunted her. To see their forms in the air of his vision. She sensed her person shimmering for him in a sidereal time whose accord with reality depended entirely on his words and actions. He held them all in the palm of his vision.
"It's past time for your morning audience, sire," Stilgar said. "Many people, curious, afraid."
"Are you afraid, Still?"
It was barely a whisper.
"Yes."
"You're my friend and have nothing to fear from me," Paul said.
Stilgar swallowed.
"Yes, my lord."
"Alia, take the morning audience," Paul said. "Stilgar, give the signal."
Stilgar obeyed. A flurry of movement erupted at the great doors. A crowd was pressed back from the shadowy room to permit entrance of officials. Many things began happening all at once. The household guard elbowing and shoving back the press of supplicants, garishly robed pleaders trying to break through, shouts, curses. Pleaders waved the papers of their calling. The clerk of the assemblage strode ahead of them through the opening cleared by the guard. He carried the list of preferences, those who'd be permitted to approach the throne. The clerk, a wiry Fremen named Tekrube, carried himself with weary cynicism, flaunting his shaven head, clumped whiskers. Alia moved to intercept him, giving Paul time to slip away with Chaney through the private passage behind the dais. She experienced a momentary distrust of Tekrube at the prying curiosity in the stare he sent after Paul.
"I speak for my brother today," she said. "Have the supplicants approach one at a time?"
"Yes, m'lady."
He turned to arrange his throng.
"I can remember a time when you wouldn't have mistaken your brother's purpose here," Stilgar said.
"I was distracted," she said. "There's been a dramatic change in you, Still. What is it?"
Stilgar drew himself up, shocked. One changed, of course, but dramatically. This was a particular view of himself that he'd never encountered. Drama was a questionable thing. Imported entertainers of dubious loyalty and more dubious virtue were dramatic. Enemies of the Empire employed drama in their attempts to sway the fickle populace. Korba had slipped away from Fremen virtues to employ drama for the Kizarat, and he'd die for that.
"You're being perverse," Stilgar said. "Do you distrust me?"
The distress in his voice softened her expression, but not her tone.
"You know I don't distrust you. I've always agreed with my brother that once matters were in Stilgar's hands, we could safely forget them."
"Then why do you say I've changed?"
"You're preparing to disobey my brother," she said. I can read it in you. I only hope it doesn't destroy you both. The first of the pleaders and supplicants were approaching now. She turned away before Stilgar could respond. His face, though, was filled with the things she'd sensed in her mother's letter, the replacement of morality and conscience with law. You produce a deadly paradox.
Tibana was an apologist for Socratic Christianity, probably a native of Four Anbus, who lived between the 8th and 9th centuries before Carino, likely in the second reign of Dalamark. Of his writings, only a portion survives from which this fragment is taken. The hearts of all men dwell in the same wilderness. From the Dune Book of Irulan. You are Bijaz, the Gola said, entering the small chamber where the dwarf was held under guard. I am called Hate. A strong contingent of the household guard had come in with the Gola to take over the evening watch. Sand carried by the sunset wind had stung their cheeks while they crossed the outer yard, made them blink and hurry. They could be heard in the passage outside, now exchanging the banter and ritual of their tasks.
You are not Hate, the dwarf said. You are Duncan Idaho. I was there when they put your dead flesh into the tank, and I was there when they removed it, alive and ready for training.
The Gola swallowed in a throat suddenly dry. The bright glow globes of the chamber lost their yellowness in the room's green hangings. The light showed beads of perspiration on the dwarf's forehead. Bijaz seemed a creature of odd integrity, as though the purpose fashioned into him by the Tlelaxu were projected out through his skin. There was power beneath the dwarf's mask of cowardice and frivolity.
Muad'Dib has charged me to question you to determine what it is the Tlelaxu intend you to do here, Hate said.
Tlelaxu, Tlelaxu, the dwarf sang. I am the Tlelaxu, you dolt. For that matter, so are you.
Hate stared at the dwarf. Bijaz radiated a charismatic alertness that made the observer think of ancient idols.
You hear that guard outside? Hate asked. If I gave them the order, they'd strangle you.
Hi, hi, Bijaz cried. What a callous lout you've become. And you said you came seeking truth?
Hate found he didn't like the look of secret repose beneath the dwarf's expression.
Perhaps I only seek the future, he said.
Well spoken, Bijaz said. Now we know each other. When two thieves meet, they need no introduction.
So we're thieves, Hate said. What do we steal?
Not thieves, but dice, Bijaz said. And you came here to read my spots. I, in turn, read yours, and lo, you have two faces.
Did you really see me go into the Tlelaxu tanks? Hate asked, fighting an odd reluctance to ask that question.
Did I not say it? Bijaz demanded.
The dwarf bounced to his feet.
We had a terrific struggle with you. The flesh did not want to come back.
Hate felt suddenly that he existed in a dream, controlled by some other mind, and that he might momentarily forget this to become lost in the convolutions of that mind. Bijaz tipped his head slyly to one side, walked all around the Gola, staring up at him.
Excitement kindles old patterns in you, Bijaz said. You are the pursuer who doesn't want to find what he pursues.
You're a weapon aimed at Muad'Dib, Hate said, swiveling to follow the dwarf. What is it you're to do?
Nothing, Bijaz said, stopping. I give you a common answer to a common question.
Then you were aimed at Alia, Hate said. Is she your target?
They call her Hort, the fish monster on the outworlds, Bijaz said. How is it I hear your blood boiling when you speak of her?
So they call her Hort, the Gola said, studying Bijaz for any clue to his purpose. The dwarf made such odd responses.
She is the virgin harlot, Bijaz said. She is vulgar, witty, knowledgeable to a depth that terrifies, cruel when she is most kind, unthinking while she thinks, and when she seeks to build, she is as destructive as a Coriolis storm.
So you came here to speak out against Alia, Hate said.
Against her?
Bijaz sank to a cushion against the wall.
I came here to be captured by the magnetism of her physical beauty.
He grinned. A Saurian expression in the big-featured face.
To attack Aaliyah is to attack her brother, Haight said.
That is so clear, it is difficult to see, Bijaz said. In truth, Emperor and sister are one person back to back, one being half male and half female.
There is a thing we've heard said by the Fremen of the Deep Desert, Haight said, and those are the ones who've revived the blood sacrifice to Shai Hulud. How is it you repeat their nonsense?
You dare say nonsense? Bijaz demanded. You, who are both man and mask? Ah, but the dice cannot read their own spots. I forget this. And you are doubly confused because you serve the Atreides' double being. Your senses are not as close to the answer as your mind is.
Do you preach that false ritual about Muad'Dib to your guards? Haight asked, his voice low. He felt his mind being tangled by the dwarf's words.
They preach to me, Bijaz said, and they pray. Why should they not? All of us should pray. Do we not live in the shadow of the most dangerous creation the universe has ever seen?
Dangerous creation.
Their own mother refuses to live on the same planet with them.
Why don't you answer me straight out? Haight demanded. You know we have other ways of questioning you. We'll get our answers, one way or another.
But I have answered you. Have I not said the myth is real? Am I the wind that carries death in its belly? No, I am words, such words as the lightning which strikes from the sand in a dark sky. I have said, blow out the lamp, day is here, and you keep saying, give me a lamp so I can find the day.
You play a dangerous game with me, Haight said. Did you think I could not understand these Zen-Sunni ideas? You leave tracks as clear as those of a bird in mud. Bijaz began to giggle. Why do you laugh? Haight demanded.
Because I have teeth and wish I had not, Bijaz managed between giggles. Having no teeth, I could not gnash them.
And now I know your target, Haight said. You were aimed at me.
And I've hit it right on, Bijaz said. You made such a big target, how could I miss?
He nodded as though to himself.
Now I will sing to you.
He began to hum, a keening, whining, monotonous theme repeated over and over. Haight stiffened, experiencing odd pains that played up and down his spine. He stared at the face of the dwarf, seeing youthful eyes in an old face. The eyes were the center of a network of knobby white lines which ran to the hollows below his temples. Such a large head. Every feature focused on the pursed-up mouth from which that monotonous noise issued. The sound made Haight think of ancient rituals, folk memories, old words and customs, half-forgotten meanings in lost mutterings. Something vital was happening here. A bloody play of ideas across time. Elder ideas lay tangled in the dwarf's singing. It was like a blazing light in the distance, coming nearer and nearer, illuminating life across a span of centuries.
What are you doing to me?
Haight gasped.
You are the instrument I was taught to play, Bijaz said. I am playing you. Let me tell you the names of the other traitors among the Naibs. They are Bikuros and Kahuit. There is DJ Dida, who was secretary to Korba. There is Abu Mojandis, the aide to Banerjee. Even now, one of them could be sinking a blade into your Muad'Dib.
Haight shook his head from side to side. He found it too difficult to talk.
We are like brothers, Bijaz said, interrupting his monotonous hum once more. We grew in the same tank, I first, and then you.
Haight's metal eyes inflicted him with a sudden, burning pain. Flickering red haze surrounded everything he saw. He felt he had been cut away from every immediate sense except the pain, and he experienced his surroundings through a thin separation like wind-blown gauze. All had become accident, the chance involvement of inanimate matter. His own will was no more than a subtle, shifting thing. It lived without breath and was intelligible only as an inward illumination. With a clarity born of desperation, he broke through the gauze curtain with a lonely sense of sight, his attention focused like a blazing light under Bijaz. Hate felt that his eyes cut through layers of the dwarf, seeing the little man as a hired intellect, and beneath that, a creature imprisoned by hungers and cravings which lay huddled in the eyes, layer after layer, until finally there was only an entity aspect being manipulated by symbols.
"We are upon a battleground," Bijaz said. "You may speak of it."
His voice freed by the command, Hate said,
"You cannot force me to slay Muad Dib."
"I have heard the Bene Gesserit say," Bijaz said, "that there is nothing firm, nothing balanced, nothing durable in all the universe, that nothing remains in its state, that each day, sometimes each hour, brings change."
Hate shook his head dumbly from side to side.
"You believe the silly emperor was the prize we sought," Bijaz said. "How little you understand our masters, the Tlelaxu. The Guild and Bene Gesserit believe we produce artifacts. In reality, we produce tools and services. Anything can be a tool. Poverty, war. War is useful because it is effective in so many areas. It stimulates the metabolism. It enforces government. It diffuses genetic strains. It possesses a vitality such as nothing else in the universe. Only those who recognize the value of war and exercise it have any degree of self-determination."
In an oddly placid voice, Hate said,
"Strange thoughts coming from you, almost enough to make me believe in a vengeful providence. What restitution was exacted to create you? It would make a fascinating story, doubtless with an even more extraordinary epilogue."
"Magnificent," Bijaz chortled. "You attack, therefore you have willpower and exercise self-determination."
"You're trying to awaken violence in me,"
Hate said in a panting voice. Bijaz denied this with a shake of the head.
"Awaken? Yes. Violence? No. You are a disciple of awareness by training, so you have said. I have an awareness to awaken in you, Duncan Idaho."
"Hate!"
"Duncan Idaho, killer extraordinary, lover of many women, swordsman, soldier, Atreides field hand on the field of battle. Duncan Idaho."
"The past cannot be awakened."
"Cannot?"
"It has never been done."
"True, but our masters defy the idea that something cannot be done. Always they seek the proper tool, the right application of effort, the services of the proper—"
"You hide your real purpose. You throw up a screen of words and they mean nothing."
"There is a Duncan Idaho in you," Bijaz said. "It will submit to emotion or to dispassionate examination, but submit it will. This awareness will rise through a screen of suppression and selection out of the dark past which dogs your footsteps. It goads you even now while it holds you back. There exists that being within you upon which awareness must focus and which you will obey."
"The Tlelaxu think I'm still their slave, but I—"
"Quiet, slave,"
Bijaz said in that whining voice. Hate found himself frozen in silence.
"Now we are down to bedrock," Bijaz said. "I know you feel it, and these are the power words to manipulate you. I think they will have sufficient leverage."
Hate felt the perspiration pouring down his cheeks, the trembling of his chest and arms, but he was powerless to move.
"One day," Bijaz said, "the Emperor will come to you. He will say, 'She is gone.' The grief mask will occupy his face. He will give water to the dead, as they call their tears hereabouts. And you will say, using my voice, 'Master, oh master.'"
Hate's jaw and throat ached with the locking of his muscles. He could only twist his head in a brief arc from side to side.
"You will say, 'I carry a message from Bijaz,'"
the dwarf grimaced.
"Poor Bijaz, who has no mind. Poor Bijaz, a drum stuffed with messages, an essence for others to use. Pound on Bijaz and he produces a noise."
Again he grimaced.
"You think me a hypocrite, Duncan Idaho? I am not. I can grieve too, but the time has come to substitute swords for words."
A hiccup shook Hate. Bijaz giggled, then,
"Ah, thank you, Duncan, thank you. The demands of the body save us. As the Emperor carries the blood of the Harkonnens in his veins, he will do as we demand. He will turn into a spitting machine, a biter of words that ring with a lovely noise to our masters.
Hate blinked, thinking how the dwarf appeared like an alert little animal, a thing of spite and rare intelligence. Harkon and blood in the Atreides?
You think of Beast Raban, the vile Harkonnen, and you glare, Bijaz said. You are like the Fremen in this. When words fail, the sword is always at hand, eh? You think of the torture inflicted upon your family by the Harkonnens, and through his mother, your precious Paul, is a Harkonnen. You would not find it difficult to slay a Harkonnen, now would you?
Bitter frustration coursed through the Gola. Was it anger? Why should this cause anger?
Oh, Bijaz said, and ah, ha, click, click. There is more to the message. It is a trade the Telelaxu offer your precious Paul Atreides. Our masters will restore his beloved, a sister to yourself, another Gola.
Hate felt suddenly that he existed in a universe occupied only by his own heartbeats.
A Gola, Bijaz said. It will be the flesh of his beloved. She will bear his children. She will love only him. We can improve on the original if he so desires. Did ever a man have greater opportunity to regain what he'd lost? It is a bargain he will leap to strike.
Bijaz nodded, eyes drooping as though tiring. Then,
he will be tempted, and in his distraction you will move close. In the instant you will strike. Two golas, not one, that is what our masters demand.
The dwarf cleared his throat, nodded once more, said,
Speak.
I will not do it, Hate said.
But Duncan Idaho would, Bijaz said. It will be the moment of supreme vulnerability for this descendant of the Harkonnens. Do not forget this. You will suggest improvements to his beloved, perhaps a deathless heart, gentler emotions. You will offer asylum as you move close to him, a planet of his choice somewhere beyond the Imperium. Think of it. His beloved restored, no more need for tears, and a place of idylls to live out his years.
A costly package, Hate said, probing. He'll ask the price.
Tell him he must renounce his godhead and discredit the Kizarat. He must discredit himself, his sister.
Nothing more? Haight asked, sneering.
He must relinquish his Chome holdings, naturally.
Naturally.
And if you're not yet close enough to strike, speak of how much the Tlelaxu admire what he has taught them about the possibilities of religion. Tell him the Tlelaxu have a department of religious engineering, shaping religions to particular needs.
How very clever, Hate said.
You think yourself free to sneer and disobey me, Bijaz said.
He cocked his head slyly to one side.
Don't deny it.
They made you well, little animal, Hate said.
And you as well, the dwarf said. You will tell him to hurry. Flesh decays, and her flesh must be preserved in a cryological tank.
Hate felt himself floundering, caught in a matrix of objects he could not recognize. The dwarf appeared so sure of himself. There had to be a flaw in the Tlelaxu logic. In making their gola, they'd keyed him to the voice of Bijaz. But what? Logic, matrix, object. How easy it was to mistake clear reasoning for correct reasoning. Was Tlelaxu logic distorted? Bijaz smiled, listened as though to a hidden voice.
Now you will forget, he said. When the moment comes, you will remember. He will say, she is gone. Duncan Idaho will awaken then.
The dwarf clapped his hands together. Hate grunted, feeling that he had been interrupted in the middle of a thought, or perhaps in the middle of a sentence. What was it? Something about targets?
You think to confuse me and manipulate me, he said.
How is that? Bijaz asked.
I am your target, and you can't deny it, Hate said.
I would not think of denying it.
What is it you try to do with me?
A kindness, Bijaz said. A simple kindness.
The sequential nature of actual events is not illuminated with lengthy precision by the powers of prescience except under the most extraordinary circumstances. The oracle grasps incidents cut out of the historic chain. Eternity moves. It inflicts itself upon the oracle and the supplicant alike. Let Muad'Dib's subjects doubt his majesty and his oracular visions. Let them deny his powers. Let them never doubt eternity. The Dune Gospels. Hait watched Alia emerge from her temple and cross the plaza. Her guard was bunched close, fierce expressions on their faces to mask the lines moulded by good living and complacency. A heliograph of thopter wings flashed in the bright afternoon sun above the temple, part of the royal guard with Muad'Dib's fist symbol on its fuselage. Hait returned his gaze to Alia. She looked out of place here in the city, he thought. Her proper setting was the desert, open, untrammelled space. An odd thing about her came back to him as he watched her approach. Alia appeared thoughtful only when she smiled. It was a trick of the eyes, he decided, recalling a cameo memory of her as she'd appeared at the reception for the Guild Ambassador, haughty against a background of music and brittle conversation among extravagant gowns and uniforms. And Alia had been wearing white, dazzling, a bright garment of chastity. He had looked down upon her from a window as she crossed an inner garden with its formal pond, its fluting fountains, fronds of pampas grass and a white belvedere. Entirely wrong. All wrong. She belonged in the desert. Hait drew in a ragged breath. Alia had moved out of his view then, as she did now. He waited, clenching and unclenching his fists. The interview with Bijaz had left him uneasy. He heard Alia's entourage pass outside the room where he waited. She went into the family quarters. Now he tried to focus on the thing about her which troubled him. The way she'd walked across the plaza? Yes, she'd moved like a hunted creature fleeing some predator. He stepped out onto the connecting balcony, walked along it behind the plasmelt sunscreen, stopped while still in concealing shadows. Alia stood at the balustrade, overlooking her temple. He looked where she was looking, out over the city. He saw rectangles, blocks of colour, creeping movements of life and sound. Structures gleamed, shimmered. Heat patterns spiralled off the rooftops. There was a boy across the way bouncing a ball in a cul-de-sac formed by a buttressed massif at a corner of the temple. Back and forth the ball went. Alia, too, watched the ball. She felt a compelling identity with that ball, back and forth, back and forth. She sensed herself bouncing through corridors of time. The potion of melange she'd drained just before leaving the temple was the largest she'd ever attempted, a massive overdose. Even before beginning to take effect, it had terrified her. Why did I do it? She asked herself. One made a choice between dangers. Was that it? This was the way to penetrate the fog spread over the future by that damnable dune tarot. A barrier existed. It must be breached. She had acted out of a necessity to see where it was her brother walked with his eyeless stride. The familiar melange fugue state began creeping into her awareness. She took a deep breath, experienced a brittle form of calm, poised and selfless. Possession of second sight has a tendency to make one a dangerous fatalist, she thought. Unfortunately, there existed no abstract leverage, no calculus of prescience. Visions of the future could not be manipulated as formulas. One had to enter them, risking life and sanity. A figure moved from the harsh shadows of the adjoining balcony, the Gola. In her heightened awareness, Alia saw him with intense clarity, the dark, lively features dominated by those glistening metal eyes. He was a union of terrifying opposites, something put together in a shocking, linear way. He was shadow and blazing light, a product of the process which had revived his dead flesh, and of something intensely pure. Innocent. He was innocence under siege. "Have you been there all along, Duncan?" she asked. "So I'm to be Duncan," he said. "Why?" "Don't question me," she said. and she thought, looking at him, that the Tlelaxu had left no corner of their gola unfinished. "Only gods can safely risk perfection," she said. "It's a dangerous thing for a man."
"Duncan died," he said, wishing she would not call him that. "I am hate."
She studied his artificial eyes, wondering what they saw. Observed closely, they betrayed tiny black pockmarks, little wells of darkness in the glittering metal. Facets. The universe shimmered around her and lurched. She steadied herself with a hand on the sun-warmed surface of the balustrade. Ah, the mélange moved swiftly.
"Are you ill?" Haight asked.
He moved closer. The steely eyes opened wide, staring. Who spoke? She wondered. Was it Duncan Idaho? Was it the Mentat Gola or the Zensuni philosopher? Or was it a Tlelaxu pawn more dangerous than any guild steersman? Her brother knew. Again she looked at the Gola. There was something inactive about him now, a latent something. He was saturated with waiting and with powers beyond their common life. "Out of my mother, I am like the Bene Gesserit," she said. "Do you know that?"
"I know it."
"I use their powers, think as they think. Part of me knows the sacred urgency of the breeding program, and its products." She blinked, feeling part of her awareness begin to move freely in time.
"It's said that the Bene Gesserit never let go," he said,
and he watched her closely, noting how white her knuckles were where she gripped the edge of the balcony. "Have I stumbled?" she asked. He marked how deeply she breathed, with tension in every movement, the glazed appearance of her eyes.
"When you stumble," he said, "you may regain your balance by jumping beyond the thing that tripped you."
"The Bene Gesserit stumbled," she said. "Now they wish to regain their balance by leaping beyond my brother. They want Chaney's baby, or mine."
"Are you with child?"
She struggled to fix herself in a time-space relationship to this question. With child? When? Where?
"I see my child," she whispered.
She moved away from the balcony's edge, turned her head to look at the Gola. He had a face of salt, bitter eyes, two circles of glistening lead, and as he turned away from the light to follow her movement, blue shadows.
"What do you see with such eyes?" she whispered.
"What other eyes see?" he said.
His words rang in her ears, stretching her awareness. She felt that she reached across the universe. Such a stretching. Out. Out. She lay intertwined with all time.
"You've taken the spice. A large dose," he said.
"Why can't I see him?" she muttered.
The womb of all creation held her captive.
"Tell me, Duncan, why I cannot see him?"
"Who can't you see?"
"I cannot see the father of my children. I'm lost in a tarot fog. Help me."
Mentat logic offered its prime computation, and he said, "The Bene Gesserit want a mating between you and your brother. It would lock the genetic." A wail escaped her.
"The egg in the flesh," she gasped.
A sensation of chill swept over her, followed by intense heat. The unseen mate of her darkest dreams, flesh of her flesh that the oracle could not reveal. Would it come to that?
"Have you risked a dangerous dose of the spice?" he asked.
Something within him fought to express the utmost terror at the thought that an Atreides woman might die, that Paul might face him with the knowledge that a female of the royal family had gone.
"You don't know what it's like to hunt the future," she said. "Sometimes I glimpse myself, but I get in my own way. I cannot see through myself."
She lowered her head, shook it from side to side.
"How much of the spice did you take?" he asked.
"Nature abhors prescience," she said, raising her head. "Did you know that, Duncan?"
He spoke softly, reasonably, as to a small child.
"Tell me how much of the spice you took."
He took hold of her shoulder with his left hand.
"Words are such gross machinery, so primitive and ambiguous," she said.
She pulled away from his hand.
"You must tell me," he said.
"Look at the shield wall,"
she commanded, pointing. She sent her gaze along her own outstretched hand, trembled as the landscape crumbled in an overwhelming vision, a sand castle destroyed by invisible waves. She averted her eyes, was transfixed by the appearance of the Gola's face. His features crawled, became aged, then young, aged, young. He was life itself, assertive, endless. She turned to flee, but he grabbed her left wrist. "I'm going to summon a doctor," he said.
"No, you must let me have the vision. I have to know."
"You are going inside now," he said. She stared down at his hand. Where their flesh touched, she felt an electric presence that both lured and frightened her. She jerked free, gasped.
"You can't hold the whirlwind."
"You must have medical help," he snapped.
"Don't you understand?"
she demanded.
"My vision's incomplete, just fragments. It flickers and jumps. I have to remember the future. Can't you see that?"
"What is the future if you die?" he asked, forcing her gently into the family chambers.
"Words, words," she muttered. "I can't explain it. One thing is the occasion of another thing, but there's no cause, no effect. We can't leave the universe as it was. Try as we may, there's a gap."
"Stretch out here," he commanded.
"He is so dense," she thought.
Cool shadows enveloped her. She felt her own muscles crawling like worms, a firm bed that she knew to be insubstantial. Only space was permanent. Nothing else had substance. The bed flowed with many bodies, all of them her own. Time became a multiple sensation, overloaded. It presented no single reaction for her to abstract. It was time. It moved. The whole universe slipped backward, forward, sideways.
"It has no thing aspect," she explained. "You can't get under it or around it. There's no place to get leverage."
There came a fluttering of people all around her. Many someones held her left hand. She looked at her own moving flesh, followed a twining arm out to a fluid mask of face, Duncan Idaho. His eyes were wrong, but it was Duncan. Child, man, adolescent, child, man, adolescent. Every line of his features betrayed concern for her.
"Duncan, don't be afraid," she whispered.
He squeezed her hand, nodded.
"Be still," he said.
And he thought, she must not die, she must not. No Atreides woman can die. He shook his head sharply. Such thoughts defied Mentat logic. Death was a necessity that life might continue.
"The Gola loves me," Aaliyah thought.
The thought became bedrock to which she might cling. He was a familiar face with a solid room behind him. She recognized one of the bedrooms in Paul's suite. A fixed, immutable person did something with a tube in her throat. She fought against retching.
"We got her in time," a voice said, and she recognized the tones of a family medic. "You should have called me sooner."
There was suspicion in the medic's voice. She felt the tube slide out of her throat, a snake, a shimmering cord.
"The slapshot will make her sleep," the medic said. "I'll send one of her attendants to—"
"I will stay with her," the Gola said.
"That is not seemly," the medic snapped.
"Stay, Duncan,"
Aaliyah whispered. He stroked her hand to tell her he'd heard.
"M'lady," the medic said, "it'll be better if—"
"You do not tell me what is best,"
she rasped. Her throat ached with each syllable.
"M'lady," the medic said, voice accusing. "You know the dangers of consuming too much melange. I can only assume someone gave it to you without—"
"You are a fool,"
she rasped.
"Would you deny me my visions? I knew what I took and why."
She put a hand to her throat.
"Leave us at once."
The medic pulled out of her field of vision, said,
"I will send word to your brother."
She felt him leave, turned her attention to the Gola. The vision lay clearly in her awareness now, a culture medium in which the present grew outward. She sensed the Gola move in that play of time, no longer cryptic, fixed now against a recognizable background.
He is the crucible, she thought. He is danger and salvation.
And she shuddered, knowing she saw the vision her brother had seen. Unwanted tears burned her eyes. She shook her head sharply. No tears. They wasted moisture, and worse, distracted the harsh flow of vision. Paul must be stopped. Once, just once, she had bridged time to place her voice where he would pass. But stress and mutability would not permit that here. The web of time passed through her brother now like rays of light through a lens. He stood at the focus, and he knew it. He had gathered all the lines to himself and would not permit them to escape or change.
Why? She muttered. Is it hate? Does he strike out at time itself because it hurt him? Is that it? Hate?
Thinking he heard her speak his name, the Gola said, M'lady?
If I could only burn this thing out of me, she cried. I didn't want to be different.
Please, Alia, he murmured, let yourself sleep.
I wanted to be able to laugh, she whispered.
Tears slid down her cheeks.
But I'm sister to an emperor who's worshipped as a god. People fear me. I never wanted to be feared.
He wiped the tears from her face.
I don't want to be part of history, she whispered. I just want to be loved and to love.
You are loved, he said.
Ah, loyal, loyal Duncan, she said.
Please don't call me that, he pleaded.
But you are, she said, and loyalty is a valued commodity. It can be sold, not bought, but sold.
I don't like your cynicism, he said.
Damn your logic, it's true.
Sleep, he said.
Do you love me, Duncan?
She asked. Yes.
Is that one of those lies? She asked. One of the lies that are easier to believe than the truth? Why am I afraid to believe you?
You fear my differences as you fear your own.
Be a man, not a Mentat, she snarled.
I am a Mentat and a man.
Will you make me your woman, then?
I will do what love demands.
And loyalty?
And loyalty.
That's where you're dangerous, she said.
Her words disturbed him. No sign of the disturbance arose to his face. No muscle trembled, but she knew it. Vision memory exposed the disturbance. She felt she had missed part of the vision, though, that she should remember something else from the future. There existed another perception which did not go precisely by the senses, a thing which fell into her head from nowhere the way prescience did. It lay in the time shadows, infinitely painful. Emotion. That was it. Emotion. It had appeared in the vision, not directly, but as a product from which she could infer what lay behind. She had been possessed by emotion, a single constriction made up of fear, grief, and love. They lay there in the vision, all collected into a single epidemic body, overpowering and primordial.
Duncan, don't let me go, she whispered.
Sleep, he said. Don't fight it.
I must. I must. He's the bait in his own trap. He's the servant of power and terror. Violence. Deification is a prison enclosing him. He'll lose everything. It'll tear him apart.
You speak of Paul?
They drive him to destroy himself, she gasped, arching her back. Too much weight, too much grief. They seduce him away from love.
She sank back to the bed.
They're creating a universe where he won't permit himself to live.
Who is doing this?
He is. Oh, you're so dense. He's part of the pattern. And it's too late. Too late. Too late.
As she spoke, she felt her awareness descend, layer by layer. It came to rest directly behind her navel. Body and mind separated and merged in a storehouse of relic visions, moving, moving. She heard a fetal heartbeat, a child of the future. The melange still possessed her then, setting her adrift in time. She knew she had tasted the life of a child not yet conceived. One thing certain about this child, it would suffer the same awakening she had suffered. It would be an aware, thinking entity before birth. There exists a limit to the force even the most powerful may apply without destroying themselves. Judging this limit is the true artistry of government. Misuse of power is the fatal sin. The law cannot be a tool of vengeance, never a hostage, nor a fortification against the martyrs it has created. You cannot threaten any individual and escape the consequences. Muad'Dib on Law, the Stilgar Commentary. Chaney stared out at the morning desert framed in the fault cleft below Sietch Tabor. She wore no stillsuit, and this made her feel unprotected here in the desert. The Sietch Grotto's entrance lay hidden in the buttressed cliff above and behind her. The desert. The desert. She felt that the desert had followed her wherever she had gone. Coming back to the desert was not so much a homecoming as a turning around to see what had always been there. A painful constriction surged through her abdomen. The birth would be soon. She fought down the pain, wanting this moment alone with her desert. Dawn stillness gripped the land. Shadows fled among the dunes and terraces of the shield wall all around. Daylight lunged over the high scarp and plunged her up to her eyes in a bleak landscape stretching beneath a washed blue sky. The scene matched the feeling of dreadful cynicism which had tormented her since the moment she'd learned of Paul's blindness.
"Why are we here?" she wondered.
It was not a hajra, a journey of seeking. Paul sought nothing here except, perhaps, a place for her to give birth. He had summoned odd companions for this journey, she thought. Bijaz, the Tlelaxu dwarf, the Gola Hate, who might be Duncan Idaho's revenant, Edric, the Guild Steersman Ambassador, Gaius Helen Mohayam, the Bene Gesserit Reverend Mother he so obviously hated, Lichna, Othheim's strange daughter, who seemed unable to move beyond the watchful eyes of guards, Stilgar, her uncle of the Naibes, and his favourite wife, Hera, and Irulan, Aliyah. The sound of wind through the rocks accompanied